Well, this afternoon we're back in the book of 1 Samuel. Remember, we have Joshua, Judges, then Ruth is in there. And then there's the two books of Samuel, the two books of Kings, and the two books of Chronicles. So we're in 1 Samuel. We were in chapter 17 this morning, looking at David and Goliath. And now we have 1 Samuel chapter 30, all the way at the end of 1 Samuel, next to the last chapter in the book. Kind of tucked away back there at the end. 1 Samuel chapter 30, a lesser known narrative with David and the Amalekite raiders. But nevertheless, a narrative that I would imagine some are familiar with. And a narrative which surely shows us that Christ is the one through whom we receive the spoils and the inheritance of God's victory on our behalf. So let's read then chapter 30 of 1 Samuel. It says there, "Now it happened, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire, and had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. So David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire. And their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. Now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, 'Please, bring me the ephod here to me.' And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them?' And he answered him, 'Pursue, for you shall surely overtake them, and without fail recover all.' So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those stayed who were left behind. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. Then they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David. And they gave him bread, and he ate. And they let him drink water. And they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. Then David said to him, 'To whom do you belong, and where are you from?' And he said, 'I am a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick. We made an invasion of the southern area of the Kerethites in the territory which belongs to Judah, and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire.' And David said to him, 'Can you take me down to this troop?' So he said, 'Swear to me by God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this troop.' And when he had brought him there, and when he had brought him down, there they were, spread out all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. Then David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Then David took all the flocks and herds they had driven before, those other livestock, and said, 'This is David's spoil.' Now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow David, whom they also had made to stay at the brook Besor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, 'Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. But David said, My brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. So it was, from that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. Now, when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. To those who were in Bethel, those who were in Ramoth of the south, those who were in Jatir, those who were in Aror, those who were in Siphmoth, those who were in Eshtemoa, those who were in Rachel, those who were in the cities of the Jarahemelites, those who were in the cities of the Kenites, those who were in Hormah, those who were in Khorasan, those who were in Athak, those who were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove. And so that ends the reading of 1 Samuel chapter 30. And we'll hear that passage in its preaching. Congregation, brothers and sisters in the Lord, this afternoon as we come to 1 Samuel chapter 30, I want us to remember to keep the same kind of focus before us that we did this morning when we looked at 1 Samuel chapter 17. That is, I want us to read and to hear this narrative, this story, this chapter on two levels. And so while we need to give attention to what it is that David is doing as we search the Scriptures, after all, that is the original historical context, and that is the plain reading of the passage. We also need to be aware of the bigger picture of redemptive history in terms of how God is working out the coming and advancement of His kingdom through Jesus Christ as we approach this passage. And this is so, boys and girls in particular, this is so, as you have learned in your catechism classes, I've read through some of the Van Dyken material, the covenantal catechism that you guys use. This is so for two reasons, that we should read this on two levels. Because in the first place, it's true that David is a type of Jesus Christ. And boys and girls, your catechism material talks about that in more than one place. That is, David, especially in his role as Israel's king, as the leader and defender of God's people, is a type of Jesus Christ. That means simply that David, in his role as king, in his role as leader and defender of God's people, he is a God-appointed picture and presentation of the one who is to come, namely, the Lord Jesus. And this doesn't mean that David was sinless, right? Obviously, he wasn't. But what it does mean is that through David, by God's own appointment, we can see, in some instances more clearly than in others, we can see the truth and promises which will come to pass fully and finally in Jesus Christ. In other words, the life of David is divinely ordained by God to teach us about the life of Jesus Christ. The one, David, points to the other, Christ. The one accomplishes his things on a limited scope, the other accomplishes his things on an infinite, unlimited scope. The one fights against Goliath and against the Amalekites. The other one fights against Satan and all of his evil host. The one recovers spoil or wins the victory for Israel. The other recovers the spoil and wins the victory for all of us as God's people. But in the second place, it's true because David as well, through David as well, not only is David a type of Christ, but through David, Christ is presently active and working in history. Active among them to overcome their enemies, as we saw in chapter 17. Because remember, it's not simply David defeating Goliath, but in that narrative, in that event, in that valley on that day, Christ was overcoming the evil one. and active among them to recover the spoil that had been, to recover all that had been lost, and to make his people share and to inherit the spoil of his victory. And so not only does David point us to the coming Christ, but as well, this is important, I think most people recognize David is a type of Christ, but we also have to recognize that David, in this case, is the agent through whom Christ works among Israel, serving even then as the good shepherd, the one who cares for his flock, who feeds them, who nourishes them, and who provides them with all that they need. And both of these things, of course, David serving as a type of Christ, and David as the one through whom Christ is active among Israel. Both of those things, as I mentioned, happen not by chance, nor are they the result of fanciful interpretation, but they are according to the design and determination of God Himself. And as such, it is to our great advantage. It is to our great advantage to read and to see and to hear the stories and narratives of the Old Testament accordingly. Therefore, beloved brothers and sisters, as we make our way through 1 Samuel chapter 30, we want to keep this theme before us. You can see it there in the bulletin. Very simple theme. Christ shares the spoil of his victory with his people. Christ shares the spoil of his victory with his people. Maybe we could even fine-tune that theme and personalize it a little bit. Christ shares the spoil of his victory with us. Christ shares the spoil of his victory with us. And again, those points, they sort of unlock the narrative and show us the flow and the structure of the passage before us. And again, like this morning, the sermon hopefully can reflect a bit of the narrative itself by being story-like. I think it's very important when preaching the Old Testament narratives is that the sermon has the same kind of flavor and feel as the text of the narrative itself. So you can see the points there. They take us all the way through the 30 verses and they unfold that one theme. Christ shares the spoil of his victory with us, his people. Now, as the narrative opens up, boys and girls, we have the setting of the stage. The setting of the stage is the first thing that the chapter has for us. In other words, in verses 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, the context of what will happen is established. The scene is set before us, and we have here the wheels beginning to grind and the wheels put in motion. Wheels which grind and are put in motion and will then carry us all the way through to the end at verse 30. At the end of chapter 29, which obviously we didn't read, but at the end of chapter 29, if you remember, David is sent on his way after the princes of the Philistines decide. David, remember, is living in Philistia. He's living with the Philistines. But David is sent on his way at the end of chapter 29 after the princes of the Philistines decide that it would be better not to have David with them in battle because they weren't sure whether or not they could completely trust him to fight on their side. So upon arriving back home in the land of the Philistines where David has been living for some time, he and his men here at the beginning of chapter 30, they come to Ziklag, a real town with kind of a strange sounding name, Ziklag. They come to Ziklag and they find out that their hometown had been burned to the ground by fire. It had been attacked by the Amalekites, and the testimony of verse 1 is that it was burned with fire. And as well, not only had the city been destroyed, but the raiders of the Amalekites had taken captive the women and those who were there from small to great. They carried them away and went on their way. That's the situation. That's the setting. The town is ashes and everybody's gone. All of their family, their wives, their sons, their daughters, everybody has been carried away by the Amalekites. Imagine how you would feel if you came home and you saw that Winnipeg had been laid flat, having been burned by the Americans. And everybody was gone and was taken captive. Imagine the tragedy and the scope and the magnitude of that destruction. The only silver lining in that scenario, like this scenario, was that nobody died. They didn't kill anybody. It tells us that in verse 2, right? At the end, it says, they had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. They weren't coming to wipe out the city of Ziklag. They were coming to burn the city, take the inhabitants, probably sell them into slavery or use them as soldiers in their army. They saw the value in the inhabitants of Ziklag, and so they took them captive as prisoners of war. So the setting of the stage involves a sketch of the situation, does it not? David and his men come to the city. There it is, burned with fire. Their wives, their sons, and their daughters have all been taken captive. That's the summary of the scene that we read in verse 3. Notice how it tells us what happened and then it tells us what happened again. Naturally then, do we read the words of verse 4? What else would we expect to hear after such a grisly picture is painted? That David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. So much sadness fills their heart at the sight of the destruction and loss which the Amalekites had brought to bear upon Ziklag and upon their families, that they quite literally cry their eyes out, weeping and wailing until there's no more tears to be shed. Their eyes run dry from the sadness that fills their hearts. And to top it all off, to make matters worse for David, who's the leader of this group, the people are planning a revolt against his leadership. So not only has David's hometown where he's living been burned to the ground, not only has his wives been taken captive, not only has David lost everything like everybody else, but now his own men are turning on him. There's grief, and it's great, no doubt. And it seems as though the people want to make David a scapegoat for the circumstances which have unfolded in front of them. They threaten to stone him to death. Threatening to stone him to death, presumably because they blame him for the loss of their sons and daughters which they have suffered at the hands of the Amalekites. Indeed, the situation is dark. Things look bleak. What is David to do? How can this wrong ever be righted? But congregation, that's the natural place that the verses lead us. But that's not where the verses leave us. They lead us to the question, how can this wrong ever be righted? But they don't leave us without an answer. Because that's not all we're told, even in this opening section, is it? Where we have the setting of the stage. No, it's not. Not by a long shot. Because the key to the opening of our narrative here is verse 6. There it says, right at the end, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. I would imagine a skilled pastor could preach an entire sermon on that verse, that part of verse 6. That David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. What precious words those are, beloved. Because not only do they set the tone and tenor for David's action and activity all the way through the rest of the chapter, because David, having strengthened himself in the Lord his God, he goes on then not only to be strengthened, but also to do the will of God by carrying out the work of God, by recovering all the things back which had been stolen by the enemy. Thus, in the strength of the Lord his God, David moves out in the rest of the chapter, and through him, Christ ministers to his people. And in this regard too, congregation, we should remember the ministry of our Lord Jesus Christ among David and his men at that time among Israel on the larger scheme of things. But also remember the ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ on its wider scale in terms of what it was that He came to accomplish. He came to recover everything that had been lost when the Garden of Eden was overthrown by the evil one and Adam and the human race was taken captive. He began His ministry in the midst of a world which was suffering under the weight and ravages of the curse. And He came to overcome the evil one and to obtain everything that He had stolen, everything that was taken away from God's image-bearing creature by the instigation and opposition of the devil. And when He did that, read Matthew chapter 4, as the Spirit of the Lord drives Him into the wilderness, as angels come and minister to Him in that context, He came to do His work, and He found His strength in God His Father. He too strengthened himself in the Lord his God for the task that was given to him. And so we see those two levels upon which we must read this passage, and they prove to be quite helpful in seeing things for what they are as far as David is concerned, while also proving to be quite helpful for seeing things how they are as far as Christ is concerned. He was no renegade. Jesus was no renegade when he came to earth. He came in submission to the will of his Father, and he depended upon God strengthening him in his human nature for that task. And what we have here in 1 Samuel chapter 30 and in this historical situation is at the same time, simultaneously, right? At the same time, it's an act of the Anointed One to presently intervene on behalf of those who are being oppressed. Okay, presently, in David's time, it's an act of the Anointed One to intervene and bring relief to those who are oppressed. And as well, it's a glimpse into the future. A glimpse into the future. And we see a picture of the ultimate victory that Christ will win for us, His beloved people. And in verses 7 through 10, we see just how it is that David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Because in these verses, David is seeking the Lord. He calls Abiathar the priest to himself, and he requests that the ephod be brought to him so that he might inquire of the Lord. Well, Abiathar brings the ephod to David, and he makes his request known to the Lord. His words are short. His request is simple. Shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? That is, O Lord, You know all things. Reveal unto Your servant Your most holy will. Should I go after the Amalekites? And if I go after them, will I obtain the victory? That's what David is asking. That's the nuts and bolts of David's request. And what is the answer that he receives, congregation? We heard it in the reading of the narrative. It tells us plainly in verse 8, the Lord answered him. He said, pursue. You shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all. Instantly, in terms of the flow of the narrative, David receives his answer. Go! And go in confidence, because you will obtain the victory and you will recover what was stolen. The emphatic language used in verse 8 when God answers David. The emphatic language in verse 8 as God speaks to David, his chosen son, is hard to miss. Because when he says, you shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all, he's giving David a promise. He's giving David a promise. A promise which will surely and without fail come to pass. And so the Lord doesn't simply answer David's prayer with a bare bones kind of word of encouragement, telling him to be strong, buck up, and go get him, David. Do your best and we'll see what happens. No, he answers David's prayer with a promise. He tells him to go after the Amalekites because the victory has already been granted into his hand. In the words of the Lord to David, congregation, what we see there in verse 8 is God's great love for His beloved Son. Because not only is He promising David the victory, not only is He promising the son of Jesse, the one that He has anointed as king and ruler over His people Israel, not only is He promising this David, the son of Jesse, a victory over the Amalekites, He is doing that. But reading this passage on two levels, we see even further that God is promising to provide for His eternal, natural Son, the one who has been appointed to rule and reign over His kingdom, the one who was sent into this world to wage the battle against the evil one, against the arch enemy, Satan himself. He is giving Him the promise of a guaranteed victory, that His mission will be successful. Those are the things that we must see and hear as we read verse 8, congregation. And hearing those words, David takes his troops, 600 men who are with him, and they head off in pursuit of the Amalekites. They head off in pursuit of their plunder. They come to the brook Besor. And for reasons which aren't entirely clear in terms of the narrative, though it may be that some of the men in David's army were suffering from extreme fatigue, it tells us that 200 of the 600 men stayed behind because they were unable to cross the brook. The rest of the men, they go with David, following him as their leader and king. Instantly, for reasons that are unknown completely, David's army shrinks by one third. He had 600, now he's down to 400. And if I won't get into it later, so I might as well mention it now. If verse 17 tells us that no one escaped except for 400 young men who rode off on camels, the indication is that David is seriously outnumbered here. If only 400 of the Amalekites escaped, and they were young men who were on camels, how many, it doesn't tell us, but how large was the Amalekite army? David and 400 men are going into a battle where they are seriously outnumbered. And as they journey through the countryside on their way toward finding the Amalekites, what is it that happens, boys and girls? You can see in the points, we're on point 3, securing the servant. David and his men come across this Egyptian man who is wandering in the wilderness. They capture him, whatever, they take him hostage, however it works out. They take him and they bring him to David and they give him bread and water to eat and drink. Also, because of his weakness and great hunger, after all, it tells us that he had had nothing to eat or drink for 3 days and three nights, the time, remember, at the beginning of the chapter, exactly corresponding to when Ziklag was attacked and burned to the ground, they give him fig cakes and raisins to eat. I remember the first time I read that passage recently, I kind of chuckled to myself and thought, maybe they gave him a slice of Mr. Bukema's baked bread, his raisin bread. That would revive anybody who was hungering and thirsting. But according to verse 12, after he receives these provisions, these fig cakes, these raisins, this bread and this water, his strength comes back to him. And in this way, David and his men, they accomplish the securing of this servant. Okay, they don't just take him hostage as a tit for tat. You took ours, we're going to take yours. No, but they take this man, they feed him, they give him water, they give him his strength back because they have some questions for him. They see the value in him, and in the Lord's providence, this Egyptian servant is the tool by which the location of the Amalekite camp is made known to David and his men. Because apparently, in verses 13 to 15, when they interrogate this young man, he had been with the Amalekites himself, had been with them as they invaded and raided parts of the south, including Ziklag. In those verses 13, 14, and 15, he basically tells them, here's what happened. Presumably, he's an eyewitness to everything that he is telling them. He was left behind by his master when he fell sick. most likely, had the Lord not led David and his men this particular direction to this particular man, he would have died. Nobody would have found him, and he never would have been brought to David, never would have been given food and water to eat and drink, and never would have told David and his men the location of the Amalekite camp. Isn't that a coincidence that they should happen upon him? Of course not. It's the providence of God, right? It's God answering David's prayer. You shall surely overtake them and certainly recover all that was lost. And initially, David sees God's promise fulfilled to him and an answer to prayer by this wandering Egyptian servant who's almost dead, had been left for dead already, and who was desperately in need of food and water. It's not coincidence. It's God's plan. It was He who led them to this Egyptian. And in securing this servant, a young man who has an important intelligence report for David and his army, God gives David a sign and confirmation of the promise which He made to him earlier back in verse 8. And we can see that this is so, congregation, because when David asks this young man, he says, "Can you lead us to the Amalekite troop?" He agrees to do so, provided that, one, David takes some kind of an oath not to kill him afterwards, and two, that David promises not to hand him back over to his former master, who, finding out that this sick servant who had been left for dead has now betrayed his former master and led David and his men right to him. So he says, "Yeah, David, I'll tell you where the Amalekites are, but don't kill me and don't hand me back over to my master." Interestingly enough, if you look at the end of verse 15, it doesn't tell us what David's answer is to this Egyptian servant, does it? We can safely assume that David agrees to protect him, that David agrees not to kill him, not to hand him back over to his master, but rather in carrying on. There they are, the ones who burned Ziklag and who carried their women and children captive. There they are. They're spread out all over the land, not a care in the world. They're eating and drinking and dancing. To use modern language, they're living large. They're chilling, these Amalekites. They don't have a care in the world. Things couldn't be better. They're enjoying the fruit of their labors because of all the great spoil which they have taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. But suddenly, and without warning, in terms of the flow of the text, the flow of the narrative, suddenly and without warning, their party is put on hold. Unexpectedly, David attacked them from twilight until evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped, except for the measly 400 young men who rode off on camels. Initially, I mean, can you imagine what it was like in the Amalekite camp? Here they are, living it up, whooping it up, enjoying the fruit of their labor, living off of the spoil they have obtained by burning the city and raiding the countryside. They must not have known what hit them. One minute, it's all good. The next minute, they're under attack. And by the time the battle's over, everybody's dead. Except for the 400 who got away on camels. Presumably, those 400 weren't soldiers, but servants, like the Egyptian boy who was left for dead. And so the army of the Amalekites, that troop of terror that had been on a merciless mission throughout the region, was brought to an untimely end. All of the horror and havoc they had been dishing out now returns upon their own head. To use the language that we heard in our Advent series from 1 Thessalonians, when they said peace and safety, then sudden destruction came upon them. The bottom line is in the end result, verses 18 and 19. David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives, and nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Thus God's promise from verse 8 comes to pass. Comes to pass. God's son, David, recovers all that the Amalekites had stolen. And God's son, Jesus Christ, recovers all that the evil one had taken away. And in this temporal victory of earthly good, which had been, this temporal recovery rather, of earthly good which had been taken captive by the Amalekites, we see that God's anointed one obtains the victory because God gives it into his hands. And we see that on two levels. So great is the recovery that a victory proclamation is made by the king. Look at verse 20. Then David took all the flocks and herds they had driven before those other livestock. And he said, "This is David's spoil. This is the inheritance. This is the booty of the battle. And it belongs to me as God's anointed one." It's not a prideful, arrogant boast, but it's a demonstration of what God has accomplished through his appointed man. What a sight to behold, brothers and sisters. What a sight to behold. As they head back, David and his men, as they head back, they come to the brook Besor. The 200 men who could not cross are still there waiting. And seeing David coming from afar, what does it tell us they do? They come out and they meet him. They come out and they meet David and those who are with them. And what does David do? It tells us that David extends greetings to these weary men, soldiers of his army, who were too weak to follow him into battle. But they had to stay behind. Look at the end of verse 21. "And when David came near the people, he greeted them." What a contrast, David's greeting and the worthless and wicked men who despise those who stayed behind. David asks how they are. How are they feeling? He comforts them. He encourages them. He loves them. He shows them that he cares for them. Now read that on the other level. Christ coming. Those followers of his who are too weak to go into battle with him. Upon returning with the spoil in tow, he comforts them, the weak ones. He encourages them, those who are weary. He loves them. He shepherds them. He shows them that he cares for them. If you're a weak sheep, and there are many of us in this congregation, then be comforted and encouraged by the tenderness of your Lord for the weak sheep in his flock. If you're a strong sheep, and there are some strong sheep in this congregation as well, be comforted and encouraged by the Lord's care, even of those who are strong, because their strength is not in themselves, but in him. But not everybody who's with David feels the same way that he does, do they? In verse 22, it tells us that all the wicked and worthless men, what a description that is, all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David, they said about these 200 who were too weary, too fatigued, too weak to continue on, they said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we recovered. Except we'll give them their wife and their children back." Why? "So that they may lead them away and depart." What a sad testimony that is to the sinfulness of the human heart. How selfish these men are. God does well to describe them for us as wicked and worthless. Here, David's army is coming off a convincing victory over the Amalekites. All of the spoil has been recovered. Everyone's family is safe and sound. And still, in spite of all that, there are actually those who are so bitter that other people stayed behind being too weak to fight in battle, that they look upon them in disgust and with a despising evil eye. Look at what jealousy can create, congregation. Where there should be celebration, there's contention. Where there should be rejoicing, there's strife. Where there should be fellowship and communion, there's conflict. But David, the shepherd and ruler and king of God's people, will have none of it. And if we didn't figure it out already, that these men were off their rocker, after all, they're described as wicked and worthless. Strong language indeed. But if we didn't figure it out already that these men were off their rocker, then we find out for sure in verse 23. Because David says, "My brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and has delivered into our hand the troop that came against us." Look in verse 22. The wicked and worthless men say, "They did not go with us. We will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered." No, David says, "No. My brethren, you will not do that. A, it's the Lord who has given us these things. He has preserved us, and He has delivered that troop into our hands." This isn't the victory we have obtained, David says. It's the victory God has obtained for us. And therefore, it's not our spoil to selfishly hoard, but it's God's spoil. It's the victory of Christ, and it is to be shared and distributed by all of His people, the strong and the weak. And so David gives in verse 23 words of rebuke and words of admonition. David reminds those who would be selfish with the spoil of the victory that the plentiful plunder that they have obtained is nothing less than the gift of God's grace. Because of this, he says, there's no room for selfish thinking and there's no room for selfish behavior. It wasn't our strength which won the war. It was God's blessing that resulted in that bounty. And David goes on in verses 24 and 25 at the end of our fifth point. David goes on then to make a statute and an ordinance in Israel. He says simply and wisely, with the authority of a king, listen to what he says, "As his part is who goes down to battle, the 400 men, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies, the 200 who didn't make it over the brook Besor. They shall share alike." And with these words, David levels the playing field among all those who belong to him, counting them as equals. Share and share alike. What we have is God's gift and blessing to us. He who fought shall receive the same as he who stayed behind. That's the stipulation that David made to be a statute on that day. And isn't it wonderful that all of us in Jesus Christ have the playing field leveled for us? Because our status and our standing, the ground of our acceptance with God, does not depend on him who wills nor on him who runs, but on God's mercy. It doesn't depend on the one who's the most faithful, like the Apostle Paul, or the one who is weak and lowly, like you or me. No, God has blessed all of us as His people who belong to Jesus Christ by true faith. All of us, from the greatest to the least, have the same ground and foundation upon which we stand, namely, the righteousness and merit of Jesus Christ. But the narrative's not over, is it? It could be. It could be. But it's not. There's still one more thing for us to uncover. And in verses 26 to 31, the high point of the entire chapter is set before us. Because here, in these verses, with all of these names that are hard to pronounce and even difficult to look at, the finishing touch is put in place on David's victory over the Amalekites. This, verses 26 to 31, that's the ribbon on the wrapping. That's the icing on the cake. This is where we see David, God's son and anointed one, who distributes the plunder of his victory throughout all the land. This is where we see that Christ shares the spoil of his victory with his people. For proof, listen to this at the end of verse 26. David said, "Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord." Not only David's soldiers are going to inherit the plunder and spoil and recovery of what was received back from the Amalekites, not only the 400 who went into battle, not only the 200 who stayed behind at the brook Besor, not only the strong, not only the weak, but David is distributing his plunder all over the land, making those who weren't even involved to share and to receive the inheritance and the victory and the spoil. From every tribe and kindred and nation and tongue, David's victory is enjoyed. Thus, through David, in that day, not only does Christ obtain victory for his people by overcoming the evil one, but as well, the Son of God distributes liberally. He distributes the share and the spoil of his victory with his people. He recovers all that had been taken captive, nothing is lost, and in turn, he spreads the wealth and plunder of what was gathered in throughout the whole land, even giving freely and abundantly to those who had no direct connection. At the end of verse 31, it says that David distributed this plunder, look at that, to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove. That's the extent of how widely the spoil of his victory was experienced and enjoyed. From the four corners of the earth, the inheritance of the evil one goes forth. Or the inheritance of the anointed one over the evil one goes forth. And what a great comfort and encouragement this ought to be to us, beloved. Because we too have been made to share in the inheritance of Christ's victory. We too are counted as heirs of this great spoil. The animals and the treasure and the people, those things specifically that pertain to this historical context, those things specifically, animals and treasure and people, okay, that may never belong to us. My wife wasn't lost in this raid, and she was never given back to me in this raid either. My children were never taken when Ziklag was burned, and they weren't given back to me in 1 Samuel chapter 30. No, there's a separation of time. There's a separation of geography. But the spiritual reality towards which those things point, namely the bestowal of God's good and gracious gifts, those things are ours. They are mine. They are yours by true faith. They are yours and mine by the grace of God given to us in Jesus Christ. We do see them. We do receive them. They are for one of us, and they are for all of us. There's no hierarchy in the Church of Jesus Christ when it comes to who it is that receives God's blessing. No, there's no caste system in the church when it comes to who it is that receives the bounty of God's plunder and the spoil of Christ's victory. All of those who belong to Jesus Christ by way of repentance and faith receive everything that God has to offer because they receive His Son. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, There is neither male nor female. There is neither slave nor free. But we are all one in Christ. Together as His people, we possess all things in common because we possess Christ and He possesses us. And by true faith, we lay hold of Him who makes us share in the spoil of His victory and makes that to be our inheritance. What a mighty God we serve, congregation. What a precious Savior we have, beloved. Because by His might and through His victory, you and me, those who are poor and destitute and without anything in our hand, have been made rich and wealthy beyond all measure. Indeed, may we move out in this year in light of God's grace which has freely been given to us. And may we seek to praise His name for all of the wonderful things that He has done for us. Amen.